Good evening, Los Angeles, and everyone listening all over the world on KBC.com. I am Alan Gervey, the managing partner of the law firm of Rowan Gervey and Wynn, and I'm going to try and get through this night without coughing my head off and be the managing partner of your life.
We're already starting off a little shaky.
This is going to be a tough one for you because we have the foremost scholar, constitutional law scholar.
I know.
And if I can't make it through the show without coughing, and by the way, I've been coughing and throwing up, so keep your distance. We're 6 feet apart.
It's not COVID though, yes?
No, and everyone says that.
Well, it sounds
you can't get sick anymore.
Horrible.
Well, I have a chronic cough. It goes back many years. And when it's bad, it's horrible. So unless COVID existed for the last 25 years,
I see.
Then... Isn't that terrible? And I'm drinking tea with honey, and I still,
yeah,
it's
no,
horrible.
You need something
stronger.
So
you're going to have to be the expert today.
Oh, boy.
The legal, are you ready for it?
We'll find out.
Okay. But, you know, I got to tell you, our guest, as brilliant as he is and as well-known as he is, he's also a nice guy, so he'll take it easy on you if you have to cross-examine him. He'll make sure. And he teaches everybody in California probably had him at one point when they were studying for the bar review courses. So everyone who is a lawyer knows that he's gentle in his teaching style. So you'll be okay, Lauren. Don't worry about it.
That's comforting. Thank you.
It is comforting. So Erwin Chemerinsky is the dean of the Berkeley Law School, and he's also the Jesse H. Schoper Distinguished Professor of Law there. Previous to being the dean of Berkeley Law, he was the founding dean of the University of California Irvine School of Law, and did a great job there at Irvine. Turned the whole program from nothing into a really well-respected law school, and he was the Raymond Pike Professor of First Amendment Law there as well. Prior to that, he was a professor at Duke University at the School of Law and the University of Southern California Law School. But not only is he well-known in academics, he has argued before the Supreme Court. He does a lot of appellate cases. He's a contributing writer for the LA Times, the Sacramento Bee, the ABA Journal, and the Daily Journal. Legal. Sorry.
That's okay.
I'm going to keep
going.
We're
still with you.
He's written 14 books and leading case books, treaties about constitutional law, criminal procedure, and federal jurisdiction. His most recent book, which we are going to talk about today, is Presumed Guilty, How the Supreme Court Empowered the Police and Subverted Civil Rights. And that came out this year. And the year before, The Religion Clauses, The Case for Separating Church and State, was his book. In 2017, he was named as the most influential person in legal education in the United States by National Jurist Magazine. Are you getting intimidated, Lauren?
A little bit, yeah.
This year, he was named president-elect of the Association of American Law Schools. That's it's a big gig.
Deal.
Yeah, it is. There's a study that was published that said that he's the most frequently cited American legal scholar. Have you ever been cited as an American legal scholar?
Not even once.
I haven't even been cited as a Canadian legal scholar. And this is the most important one for all of you lawyers and budding lawyers. In 2011, the National Jurist Magazine described him as one of the 23 law professors to take before you die.
Before you die. Wow.
Isn't that something?
Like a bucket list.
Dean Chemerinsky, welcome back to Gervey's Law.
It's a pleasure. Thank you for that incredibly kind and generous introduction.
Well, it's all true. I didn't make any of it up.
Thank you.
Okay.
It's quite a resume.
We have a lot to talk about, Erwin, today, and I'm going to do something a little different. The Supreme Court takes on certain cases, and I know you're not a big fan right now of the Supreme Court. We'll be talking about that. They take on certain cases. We don't know how they choose them. There's so many that try to get to the Supreme Court, and I think maybe they take 80 or so. and then they have a schedule, and you can follow them on the schedule to see when what cases will be heard at what times during the year. So we're going to give you that right now, the right of the guest today to choose which topic you want to start with. And here are your five topics. Are you ready? This is like a game show.
I like it.
All right. You ready? Okay. So here are the five topics. You choose the first one, and then we'll go through the others as you desire. All right. First one. This is an obvious one. The vaccination mandates. Will legal challenges against President Biden's policies prevail? And then other assorted topics relating to vaccination mandates. Number two, why is the California recall process unconstitutional, in Erwin Chemerinsky's words? Number three, Erwin Chemerinsky went at it with the newest Supreme Court justice, Amy Coney Barrett. Partisan hacks? That's number, what am I, number four or number three?
Four.
Four. So we're going to have to talk about your
five.
LA Times opinion piece where you corrected the newest member of the judiciary Supreme Court who claims they're not partisan hacks. And you corrected her and said, by the way, they are partisan hacks. And number five is presumed guilty, how the Supreme Court empowered the police and subverted civil rights. Your book from this most recent past year.
I hope we can talk about all of those. And, of course, the one I most want to talk about is my book. Other than talking about my grandchildren, that's what I'd most like to talk about. So let me start with your number one topic, and that's the vaccination mandate. I think it's important here to separate out who is being regulated. So part of President Biden's vaccination mandate is for federal employees. And I think that is clearly constitutional. Any court would uphold it. The president has the authority to make rules for the executive branch of government by executive order, so long as they don't violate a statute of the Constitution. There is no constitutional right to not be vaccinated. In 1905, in Jacobson v. Massachusetts, the Supreme Court said the government can require that people be vaccinated. The court rejected the argument that there's an individual liberty interest to not be vaccinated. Every state requires children to be vaccinated against many communicable diseases. Every challenge to those laws has failed. The harder part of the Biden vaccination mandate is asking the Occupational Safety and Health Administration to use its emergency power to require that all employers with more than 100 employees have their employees vaccinated. The issue there is that just too broad a delegation of power to an administrative agency? Is it too much of a stretch to use that power to force vaccination? It's not about a right to be not vaccinated. That doesn't exist. So does the Occupational Safety and Health Administration have that authority? And I think that's a very hard question and hard to predict what the Supreme Court would do.
And well, how do we deal with that in the past, out of curiosity?
Well, usually vaccinations have been required at the state level. The case that I mentioned with smallpox in 1905 was at the state level. All 50 states require children going to school be vaccinated. My university requires students attending be vaccinated. What makes this different is the attempt to do it at the national level. And that's why I said within the executive branch for federal employees, Biden has that authority. But to impose it on private business without a specific law, using a general statute, that's much more questionable.
So let's break this down. There's two issues here. One is procedural and one is substantive. And when we talk about procedural, I think that's what you're getting at. Most people want to talk about the substantive issue, which you've touched on with respect to Jacobson in Massachusetts and with respect to the historical ability for rights to be I would say, I don't know what you're saying. They're limited in a sense. I mean, I always think back to Lord of the Flies, the William Golding book, and what happened when there were no rules. And an example, can't believe I'm coughing so much, an example of why there may be a need to have some sort of rules for the greater good. And then you have to weigh, does COVID fall into that where it would be part of this kind of theory? But before we get to that, talk a little bit about the procedural levels. A lot of people, and I think Justice Kavanaugh may have hinted at this when he was a D.C. Circuit Court judge, talk about the major rules doctrine and what you were saying in terms of the federal government maybe not having the right, especially through the president's mandate, to be able to do this constitutionally. Talk a little bit about why the major rules doctrine comes into play.
Sure. I want to separate this out, not in terms of procedure and substance, but in terms of, does the government have the authority? And even if the government has the authority, is it infringing somebody's rights? States have the authority to do anything except what the Constitution prohibits. So if California was to require every person to be vaccinated, there's no doubt it has the authority. Now, we could argue, does it infringe people's rights? And I think the answer is no, but we're not talking at the authority level. The federal government, though, only has the authority to act if it can point to specific authority in the Constitution and in a federal statute. The problem here is that there's no federal statute that clearly gives the federal government the authority to impose vaccination requirements on employers who have more than 100 workers. But there is a federal statute that has very general language, the Occupational Safety and Health Administration Act, that gives to that agency, the Occupational Safety and Health Administration, the power to create emergency rules to protect safety in the workplace. And the question is such a broad delegation of power enough to justify this specific regulation? And here I think we have a majority of the court, maybe six justices, who are very skeptical of allowing such broad delegations of power.
And that's assuming that it gets to the court. When you talk about OSHA, is this only a rule that Congress must authorize with respect to OSHA enforcing it? When you, even if President Biden gets away with this in some way or fashion, how is it enforced by OSHA?
Well, the way in which Biden has imposed the mandate for vaccination on the private sector is to say, Occupational Safety and Health Administration, use your emergency power to force employers to require their employees be vaccinated. If Congress wanted to pass a statute that said that explicitly, Congress could do so as part of regulating commerce among the states. If California wanted to do that, it could. But the Occupational Safety Health Statute is so general and so broad, I think it's uncertain whether the current court would allow it to be used in that way.
All right. Well, we got to take a break. I want to pick up just a couple minutes because we're going to move on, but we want to talk a little bit about what you see in your crystal ball, whether this goes to the Supreme Court, whether when it is implemented, people are going to follow it. Are people going to stop working? Is this going to stress unemployment? Or how is everything going to shake out as we move into October? And also about booster shots. We want to talk a little bit about that. And we'll talk more with Dean Erwin Chemerinsky after this. You're listening to Gervie's Law right here on Talk Radio 790 KBC. Yeah, we're back. You know, Lauren, the problem is we don't know what science is. I often hear people say, follow the science, mm-hmm. or they're not dealing with science. But it's become, unfortunately, part of the media, one way or the other. You know, and it's just like, it's the way to argue now to say, you don't understand the science, so you're not listening to the science.
Right. I mean, it's politicized now.
It is.
Science.
And it seems like everything's politicized. And we have to talk to our guest, Dean Erwin Chemerinsky of Berkeley Law School. We were talking about vaccination mandates before the break. Just want to pick up a little bit about what I said. And for those of you who are just joining me, I'm apologizing for my cough.
He's about to die.
Thank you. Uncontrollable. And we want to ask you, Erwin, looking into your crystal ball, we're getting into some, you know, not only the excitement of baseball wild card race, but we're getting to the nitty gritty on the mandates and implementing them. How's this all going to go down? What kind of legal challenges? I know they're out there. What do you think? Because before the break, you said some interesting things that really balance this issue one way or not the other way. So exactly what can we expect?
I think we can expect that people who don't want to be vaccinated, who try to argue that it violates their rights, will lose in court. So far, all of those who've tried to argue that there's some personal right to not be vaccinated have not succeeded. As an example, some Indiana University students challenged the university's requirement that all students be vaccinated. They lost. The Federal Court of Appeals in Chicago wrote a very strong opinion saying there's no such right, and the Supreme Court denied review. I think the cases about vaccination that have a chance of succeeding are those that argue about whether the federal government has power to do something like require all employers with more than 100 workers to mandate vaccinations.
So it's more of a question of, as you said earlier, the breadth of their authority.
That's right. I think that the one part of the vaccine mandate that's really of questionable legality is using the Occupational Safety and Health Administration in this way. But if you think about California requiring vaccinations or my university requiring it, no doubt that the government will win and the challengers will lose. The law is just absolutely clear in terms of the ability of the government to require vaccination to stop the spread of a communicable disease.
And in your particular university at Berkeley, have you had meetings where you've discussed this, and what policies are they pursuing?
I am in constant meetings about how all of this gets implemented, but the university has required that all students, staff, and faculty be vaccinated. There can be an exemption for medical reasons, and there can be a religious exemption. And everyone must wear masks at all time in the building, unless they're alone in a private office. No exceptions. And people do. And thankfully, we've had very few cases in our first 6 weeks of school.
Have you had students who are refusing to attend school? And if so...
Or faculty.
Or faculty. What do you do about it?
The answer is no, we have not had that. I certainly had some students who objected to having to be vaccinated, and they had the choice. They could be vaccinated or take time off of school and come back when this is all over, but there's no exceptions based on I don't believe in vaccination or I don't think it's safe or anything like that. And thankfully, we've had no problems with our faculty, staff, or students in that regard.
Is this going to divide our country even more when we look at it on the state level and see that other states may not be supporting some of the policies that a state like California is pursuing?
I think it is so tragic that the issue of vaccination and the issue of masks have become political. Mm. This shouldn't be politicized. When I was a child, they developed the polio vaccine. Can we imagine then that people would say, I have a right to not have vaccination against polio? We'd have never imagined that. Or could we imagine in the turn of the 20th century people saying, I have a right to not be vaccinated against smallpox? That did get to the Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court said, no, your right to swing your fist stops at another person's nose. When it's a communicable disease, you don't have a right to take the risk of infecting others.
You know, when you say that, it begs the question whether the makeup of this Supreme Court would take that position. Mm-hmm. And it kind of segues to the topic of the politicization of the Supreme Court and, you know, what we're going to talk about with your LA Times op piece. But
I'm also just wondering, if I might, when the smallpox case went to the Supreme Court, was it as politicized as it is today? Was it a clear, like, right versus left issue?
No. I mean, there's never been a public health crisis that was politicized in the way this is. Mm. You know, certainly the time of the Spanish flu, there were debates over whether there should be masks or not, but it wasn't tracking partisan lines like this. I've often wondered if Donald Trump in March of 2020 had said, we're all in this together, this is a communicable disease, we have to do what's necessary to stop it from spreading. I think we're in a very different place now. I also think he would have been reelected as president. Mm. And unfortunately, he chose a different tact, and I think we're seeing the consequences of his politicizing the pandemic.
Yeah, I think you're right about that. It seems clear that it has just caused division versus any unification. Last question on this topic, booster shots. It's becoming more in vogue to talk about whether or not It's necessary, and today I think they talked about Pfizer saying that maybe for people over 65 or people who are at risk. In terms of booster shots, as we move forward, how do you track whether, excuse me, you want to finish my thought here?
I'm going to guess what your thought is.
Yeah, go ahead.
How do we track who's got what vaccine and who has boosters?
Well, when we talk about universities and healthcare facilities, how do we track if people are getting them? Are we looking at dates on vaccination cards? Or what really do we look at for any future restrictions based on booster shots versus just two vaccinations as we're dealing with now?
Right now, where I live in Oakland or I work in Berkeley, in order to go into any restaurant, you have to show your vaccination card. And they can see on my vaccination card, which I just picked out of my desk, you can see the type of vaccine I got and the dates that I got it. In fact, in order to eat in my law school cafe, in light of the Berkeley rules, somebody has to show that they've been vaccinated and that it's met the university's requirements. If we get to a point where a third shot is required, we'll just take these existing rules and have it apply to that as well.
Yeah, I guess that's what we have to look forward to, Lauren.
Mm-hmm. It doesn't seem like it's over and done with just yet.
It's going to get interesting if it isn't already. All right, Professor Chemerinsky, tell us where we're going next. Are we going to your book, Presumed Guilty, How the Supreme Court Empowered the Police and Subverted Civil Rights, which came out this year? Are we going to the Dobbs v. Jackson Women's Health Organization case that's being heard at Supreme Court December 1st? Are we going to your September 19th Los Angeles Times opinion piece titled "Are Supreme Court Justices Partisan Hacks?" And the evidence says yes. Where are we going?
I would talk about any of those, but I'm sure if you asked any author, would you like to talk about your new book? The answer would be, of course. The book was published just last month. It's titled, as you said, Presumed Guilty, How the Supreme Court Empowered the Police and Subverted Civil Rights. And the theme of the book is that throughout American history, the Supreme Court has failed to enforce the constitutional provisions that were meant to constrain the police. The Fourth Amendment that says the police is supposed to get a warrant, a probable cause for stopping, searching, arresting. The Fifth Amendment that says that you have the privilege against self-incrimination. And what I try to say in the book is that instead of constraining the police, the Supreme Court has empowered them. That it's not hyperbole to say the police can stop literally anyone anytime they want and search that individual. It's not hyperbole to say the Supreme Court has refused to put limits on eyewitness identification procedures like lineups, even though we know they lead to the conviction of innocent people. Mm. And all of this has led to very racialized policing. A black man has 9 times the chance of being killed by the police than others in our society.
When you write a book like this, obviously you have the ideas and you've done so much work in this regard that you kind of know what you want to say. But when you were actually doing the research and going through case after case that you may not have been familiar with, was there anything that surprised you in terms of the volume of cases that supported your premise?
Yes. What I was most surprised by, how for the first 100 years of American history, there weren't Supreme Court cases dealing with these issues at all.
Wow.
And I decided that I was going to tell this story historically. And I obviously know the more recent cases. I've been teaching this material for over 40 years. But I'd never really focused very much on the 19th century. And I was stunned and learned a great deal that I didn't know. I mean, I never realized how organized police forces came about only after the Civil War. Hmm. That early in American history, there'd be a sheriff or a marshal, but he needed a force, he'd round up a posse.
Wow.
That the real first police forces were slave patrols that were organized in the South to catch fugitive slaves. And it is a true statement that you don't find any Supreme Court cases about the Fourth Amendment for the first 100 years of American history.
And, you know, the other thing that I've noticed just in my lifetime is the militarization of the police forces. I mean, Now when you show up at a scene, I mean, I'm a reporter, so when you show up at a scene and you see military gear, the police force is no longer just, you know, a handgun and cuffs. They have everything the military force has. And that, I assume that's pretty recent as well.
It is. I mean, it's a result of federal aid to police departments to get this. It's a result of the technology developing. It's a result of an attitude of police that I think is often militaristic. But I've got to tell you, in Los Angeles, that's long been the attitude of the LAPD. Going back to Chief Parker in the 1950s, it was very much a militaristic us versus them attitude. And so this is what I wanted to write about in the book, and I wanted to tell the history. And because I lived in Los Angeles for so many years, and because I had done a study of the Los Angeles Police Department, there's a lot in the book about the LAPD.
Before we take a break, I just want to read one of the many outstanding reviews of the book. Presumed Guilty is a must-read and provides very important context regarding crucial Supreme Court decisions and how these decisions have perpetuated systemic racism, especially via policing. He writes about these cases in a very understandable way, and the way he is able to link together the history of these cases helps to bring into clear focus the problems of policing. Professor Chemerinsky also shades important nuance to past court errors that have otherwise been overly simplified as bad, good by too many. For a reader with no knowledge of the legal history surrounding policing, Presumed Guilty is essential reading. Mm. That's high praise.
It's very kind, and it wasn't written by one of my children.
No, it wasn't. At least not with the same name.
Okay.
We got to take a break. We're going to talk a little bit more of how you can get the book, because we don't want to just tease you that there's this book that you need to read. We need to tell you how you can get it. You'll hear that after the break. You're listening to Gervie's Law right here on Talk Radio 790 KBC. All right, we are back. We're talking to Professor Erwin Chemerinsky, the Dean of the Berkeley Law School. And before the break, we were talking about his most recent book, which is really a timely book given what's gone on
Sure.
over the last year and a half, couple years. The book is Presumed Guilty, How the Supreme Court Empowered the Police and Subverted Civil Rights. Sorry.
That's okay.
I get choked up.
I know. It's very emotional.
Erwin, you know, it's really interesting. A lot of books provide a historical sketch of the subject matter, but very few take it one step further to look at suggestions of how the current issues can be remedied, and in this case, to making policing more balanced in how it's approached in policy and in law. And that's what you do in the last chapter of the book. You don't leave people hanging. You actually have suggestions on trying to remedy something historically that has really caused a great unequal balance in our society.
That was very much my goal. And I want to offer concrete suggestions and also paths to get there. I don't think the Supreme Court is going to, in the foreseeable future, be the institution to control the police. But Congress can pass statutes that control policing in the country. State legislatures can do that. City councils, police commissions can. Just to give you an example, after the tragic death of George Floyd, many cities prohibited their police departments from using the chokehold. What killed George Floyd, what killed Eric Garner, and killed many in Los Angeles. That could be done by Congress, but it can also be done by a state legislature or by a city. Also, if the Supreme Court isn't going to protect rights, state Supreme Courts interpreting state constitutions can do so. The Supreme Court has said it's fine for police to stop people on a pretext. A police officer can follow somebody and pull them over for changing lanes without a signal or not stopping long enough at a stop sign when the real goal is to search for drugs in the car. Many states have said no, such pretextual searches aren't allowed. The Supreme Court since 1986 has only had one case dealing with police eyewitness identifications, but state courts have imposed limits. And also it's important to note there is a federal statute that allows the Justice Department to go after cities when there's a pattern and practice of civil rights violations, and the Justice Department needs to use that. So my point in this last chapter is there are many ways to bring about reform, and there's much that can be done.
I wonder what your opinion of the defund the police movement has been, because we saw that really gain a lot of traction, especially in Minneapolis, where George Floyd was killed. And, you know, I think now the reality of it is setting in, and some opinion has turned whether just defunding the police and disbanding police units is the right thing to do, or the other option is, you know, sending in mental health experts instead of police in many of these situations, like domestic violence or, you know, dealing with homeless. What's your opinion?
We need to be careful when we use the phrase defund the police, and you've shown it can have two different meanings. One is sometimes it's said to be abolish the police.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's nonsense. Every society needs law enforcement.
Right.
None of us would want to live in a city where there's no possibility of apprehending criminals or convicting criminals. Besides that, all that would happen would be people who could afford it would hire private security forces, and they wouldn't even have to comply with the Constitution. Now,
right.
Defund police might have a different meaning, and that would say, let's look selectively and see if there's some tasks that now we ask the police to do that we might shift to other social service agencies. I think mental health functions that police have often picked up by default, so there's no one there, might be better done by somebody else. But as I argue in the book, I strongly oppose abolishing the police. I am not anti-police. I have the highest regard for the police, but they have tremendous power, and it has to be controlled.
I think that's why it makes a lot of sense to read the book, so that you can see this kind of balanced approach to addressing a problem without this reactionary kind of drastic measure that not a lot of people would support and would probably result in a lot of civil unrest, and that's putting it mildly. Where do you suggest you get the book? Amazon or
any place?
Any place.
Any place. It's available in bookstores. It's available on all the online booksellers. In fact, I was shocked 2 weeks ago when I was reading the Los Angeles Times to see that week it was number 7 on the nonfiction bestseller list in the LA Times. So it's obviously available. I'd never had that happen of a book I wrote before.
Well, congratulations.
Congratulations.
And it's
well
deserved.
Yeah.
I think a lot
we'll
of people
see.
Are interested in this subject, and everyone should get out there and get a copy.
Thank you.
It's a great read. Now, I'm going to choose the next topic. I'm not going to put you on the spot. You've been on the spot enough. We're going to talk quickly about your, you mentioned the LA Times, you read the LA Times, and you apparently write an opinion piece for it too on September 19th. How outraged were you to see Justice Amy Coney Barrett criticizing the notion that the court is full of partisan hacks during a speech at the Mitch McConnell Center of the University of Louisville Law School, of all places, and especially given the fact that perhaps she's more of the new kid on the block and being that outspoken? Was that appropriate?
Sure, it was appropriate. I think it was Shakespeare said, doth protest too much.
Yeah.
She gave a speech that says justice just aren't partisan hacks. And my response was, and that's what this piece says, is, well, if you don't want to be thought like partisan hacks, don't act like partisan hacks. And what really has troubled me a lot, and this is what I say in the piece, is there have been a series of Supreme Court decisions in the last decades that have tremendously favored Republicans at the polls. And all of these cases have been 5-4 or 6-3 with the Republican appointees in the majority. I've been especially upset by Citizens United versus Federal Election Commission, that says corporations can spend unlimited amounts of money in election campaigns, or the decisions that gutted the Federal Voting Rights Act, which I regard as one of the most important laws adopted in my lifetime, or cases that say there can't be judicial challenges when there's partisan gerrymandering, when the political party that controls the legislature draws districts to preserve their safe seats. And my point here was, you're acting in a partisan way. People are going to perceive it in a partisan way.
You know, in the past, we've had Brian Leiter, professor of university, professor of law at University of Chicago Law School on, and he called, he's been all over this notion for years now. It's nothing new for him. And he called it the super legislature of last resort. Why, when he said that, did that not get into the news? But when Erwin Chemerinsky talks about the partisan hacks and all the evidence that says yes, it becomes a big thing.
Oh, I think when any of us say it, it gets some attention. But I think the point is that we have a very conservative Supreme Court right now. Now, the reality is the court has always been ideological. The decisions of the justices always reflect their life experience and their beliefs. It's just now, it's a court that has five staunch conservatives, Thomas, Alito, Gorsuch, Kavanaugh, and Barrett, one moderate conservative, Roberts, and three liberals, in Breyer, Sotomayor, and Kagan. For the listeners who are politically conservative, this is a time to celebrate. But we should also call it for what it is. It's a very conservative court that rules in a very conservative way.
The fact that you can say that gives substantiation to your argument that it can be pigeonholed in this way, and it's not a sense where each issue is looked at individually on its merits, but is more appropriate looked at by virtue of the political disposition and perhaps who appointed the specific Supreme Court justice.
I think that to some extent that's always been so, but it's more now. There were presidents who weren't particularly ideological. Dwight Eisenhower, he picked a Democrat, William Brennan, for the Supreme Court. He picked Earl Warren, who turned out to be one of the most liberal chief justices ever, not the most liberal chief justice ever. But the reality is more recent presidents have been more ideologically defined. Also, the base of each party has wanted much more of an assurance that candidates are being picked to please them. Donald Trump said openly he was going to pick Supreme Court justices to overrule Roe versus Wade. Barack Obama was clear that he was going to pick liberal justices for the court, and then you end up with the court that we have today.
And then there's also the case of Merrick Garland, which we won't talk about, but it really would have changed the nature of the court, at least to the degree of having someone who is a little less conservative on the court. That's another subject for another day. You mentioned Roe versus Wade. We got to take a break, but you know what we're going to talk about after the break.
Sure.
Roe versus Wade and Dobbs versus Jackson Women's Health Organization. Going to the Supreme Court December 1st. You're listening to Gervie's Law right here on Talk Radio 790 KABC. All right, we're back, and I'm just reading some listeners trying to fix my cough. Thank you so much for this recommendation. I'm going to try it. I really need to get
What's the recommendation?
I have to click on it to get to a website. It's Ridgecrest Clear Lungs Extra Strength Herbal Decongestant 60 Vegan Capsules.
Oh.
I will try it. Now I'll try anything.
Posting products on here.
We're talking,
you need something, that's
I
for
do,
sure.
And I appreciate that. Thank you for that advice. We're talking to Erwin Chemerinsky, and we only have a few minutes left. We have to talk about Dobbs v. Jackson. Hopefully, we don't have to talk. You have to talk about it. Supreme Court taking it up. Erwin, why are they taking up this case?
Because I think there's a majority of the justices that want to overrule Roe versus Wade, either explicitly or effectively. Dobbs involves a Mississippi law that prohibits abortion after the 15th week of pregnancy. In Roe versus Wade in 1973, the Supreme Court said states cannot prohibit abortion before viability, the time at which the fetus can survive outside the womb. In 1992, in Planned Parenthood versus Casey, the Supreme Court said the essential holding of Roe is states can't prohibit abortion before viability. Viability is the 24th, maybe the 23rd week of pregnancy. The Supreme Court granted review on one question: can states prohibit abortion before viability? There were many other state laws that did this that have been struck down in the past. The Supreme Court never took them. That the Supreme Court took this case, that the Supreme Court 3 weeks ago wouldn't stop the Texas law from going into effect, I think is a strong indication that we have five justices on this court that want to overrule Roe.
Yeah, I think that makes a lot of sense, Lauren.
It's hard for me to imagine a world where we overrule Roe. It wasn't like there was no abortion before Roe versus Wade. It was just for people with enough money or people who could travel out of, you know, the area which they lived in to an area where it was legal. So where do you see the future if they're able to overturn it?
I think the future is just what you describe, what the past was before Roe. Before New York became the first state in this country to legalize abortion, 25% of the abortions in England were performed on American women. It wasn't poor women who were going to England for abortions.
Right.
If Roe is overruled, abortion will stay legal under California law, New York law, and Illinois law. But over half the states will prohibit all abortions. Women in those states with money will travel. Women who are too poor or teenagers, they'll be left to the choice between an unwanted child and finding an unsafe back alley abortion.
Aren't we also going to see a lot of protests, and 2022 may be the year of the pro-choice versus the pro-life again? Isn't it? Aren't we going backwards?
There's no doubt that if Roe is overruled, in many states, there'll be a fight over abortion. What's interesting is opinion polls show over 60% of the American people believe that women should have the right to abortion, but they're not evenly distributed through the states. So in places like California and New York, abortion rights are secure, but in many states, the population strongly opposes abortion, and it's in those states that women will either travel, pay off a friendly doctor, or have an unwanted child, or I worry again, but what we had prior to 1973 was unsafe back alley abortions.
Wow, you sound so defeated when you talk about this.
I feel defeated.
Well, I think when you look at the makeup of the Supreme Court, that really kind of tells the tale. And that's why even someone like Erwin Chemerinsky, who has all the legal background, feels that, hey, it doesn't matter.
But we are in a time now where abortion is not necessarily has to be done in a clinic by a doctor. I mean, we have the morning after pill now. We also have pills that you can take later on in a pregnancy. What happens to access to that?
That will be restricted as well, because states that want to prohibit abortion will say that the morning after pill is a form of abortion, where they'll say that RU486, the drugs that can be used in the first 10 weeks for a medically induced abortion, are also illegal, and they'll also be prohibited in those states. Now, of course, women who can travel can go and get those drugs, but think about the poorer women and think about the teenagers.
You know, we're just going to have to stay tuned. So many fascinating issues that we're going to be looking at in the future. We'll have to talk about this as it gets closer to December 1st and the aftermath. Before I let you go, and by the way, Dean Chemerinsky, we almost got to all of our topics. We didn't get to the California recall, but hey, Lauren, it's passed.
It's a spoiler. Yeah, we know what happened.
I mean, you, Erwin, you were all over the media talking about the unconstitutionality of it, so we don't have to talk about it anymore. I think something has to be done, but what's done is done. It's over. So I'm sorry we didn't get to talk about it. One last thing before I let you go. I do want to say, Erwin, thank you very much for agreeing to speak at the California Applicant Attorneys Association conference in Rancho Mirage, where Lauren lives, close to there.
Very close.
And in late January. And I haven't talked to you about this, but how is this for a topic? We need to put your keynote address. We need a topic, and there's so many things to talk about. How about constitutional rights in the workplace, status of Prop 22, discrimination based on race, age, and gender, vaccination mandates, and legal education in 2022?
That's a lot for one talk, but I'll talk about anything you want. You choose.
You have to tell me right here on the air. What do you want cut out of there? Constitutional rights in the workplace, status of Prop 22, discrimination based on race, age, and gender, vaccination mandates, and legal education in 2022.
Talk with your colleagues, and whatever you want me to come talk about would be my honor and pleasure.
You mean you will be able to just talk about anything? That's incredible.
Give me advance notice.
I will.
He knows it all.
You will get advance notice.
I'm honored to be asked, and I'll come talk about whatever is of most interest to your audience.
That sounds great, and everyone will be very interested to hear what you say, and I'm sure there'll be a lot of questions. Dean Chemerinsky, as usual, we really appreciate you taking an hour out of your very busy schedule to talk about all of these important issues. And again, I just want to say that the book is called Presumed Guilty, How the Supreme Court Empowered the Police and Subverted Civil Rights. Came out just recently. It's doing great. Number 7, LA Times.
Amazing.
It was a couple of weeks ago. Well, let me say thank you for having me, and I hope you feel better, too. Thanks for making it through this program.
I appreciate it. You made it easier for me. Now I'm going to go and cough my head
off,
but it doesn't matter.
I can see why you dragged yourself in here. Erwin, you were very enlightening in so many ways.
Thanks.
My great pleasure.
And be
thank
well.
You.
We'll be in touch. Thanks, Erwin.
Thank you.
All right. Take care. Wow.
Still alive.
I'm still
here
alive.
And kicking.
Thank you for being here for me because, you know, picking up the pieces. It's been tough, but we made it.
Thank our engineer who's quick on the mic.
Yeah, people don't know how much I was coughing, but Damon was just pressing that button quickly to make sure that you didn't hear all the hacking. At least I didn't throw up. Usually I throw up when I'm coughing so much.
Oh, I'm so delighted that didn't happen today.
Yeah, I spared
you. Go home
I
and get
you.
Some I'm, rest I'm gonna, and stop talking, my God.
I gotta stop Alan. Talking. Thanks for listening. We will be back next week. Who's on next week? Do you remember?
I do, but we're not going to promote it because you know what happens anytime we promote a guest, Alan.
Really?
Yeah.
Who is it?
It's Murphy's Law.
Murphy's Law is on next week?
I mean, you know what I mean.
I know what you mean. All right, well, thanks for listening. Have a great week. Don't cough as much as I do, and everyone stay well. We will see you next week.